All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, and today is a Best of Veterans Radio from 2021. We're going to be talking with James Kitfield. He's the author of In the Company of Heroes, the inspiring stories of Medal of Honor recipients from America's longest wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Just a great story and I think a really good interview. So I want you to stick around and listen to that. And we'll get right into that. But first, I know we have to thank our sponsors always. So first of all, we've got Legal Help for Veterans, specializing in veterans' disability claims. Give Legal Help for Veterans a call at 800-693-4800. The National Veterans Business Development Council, better known as NVBDC, is the nation's leading third-party authority for certification of veteran-owned businesses. For more information, go to their website, nvbdc.org, or give them a call at 888-237-8433. The Charles S. Kettles VA Medical Center in Ann Arbor, Michigan. More information, go to va.gov/Ann Arbor Healthcare. The National Vietnam Veterans of America, never again will one generation of veterans abandon another. For more information, go to their website, vva.org. And our two local veteran service organizations, the Irwin Prescott and American Legion Post 46 and the Charles S. Kettles Vietnam Veterans of America Chapter 310, both of Ann Arbor, Michigan. If you'd like to support Veterans Radio, please go to our website, veteransradio.org, click on the donate button, and thank you in advance. The other thing is I got to remind you of Radio on the River coming up on September 22nd. This is our annual fundraiser, so go to our website, veteransradio.org, click on the beautiful picture of the Huron River. You'll find out all the information. We're looking forward to seeing you there. Hope you come on out. We'd love to see you and have you meet all of the members of the Veterans Radio crew. All right, so here we go. Straight into our interview with James Kitfield, In the Company of Heroes.
Well, as I was reading this book, In the Company of Heroes, and thinking about all of these amazing men who are in a volunteer army to begin with. And I don't know about you, but that takes a lot of courage right there, I think. And their missions that they had, especially in Afghanistan that I've been reading about, of course, in Iraq and Fallujah, and the stories that we've heard about these men on Veterans Radio, actually, I just had to get a hold of this book. And so I want to bring on the author of In the Company of Heroes. His name is James Kitfield. He is a senior national security and foreign affairs correspondent for the National Journal Magazine. He has written on defense, national security, and foreign policy issues from Washington, D.C. for over two decades. He has written about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he's been reporting from the Middle East, Asia, Latin America, Africa. Seems like you've been everywhere, so I want to welcome and just get you right on the air. So, James Kitfield, welcome to Veterans Radio.
It's great. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much for agreeing to be on the program. As I was reading through the book and about, you know, the SEALs and the combat control guys from the Air Force and, you know, Marines, everything else that is out there, how did you get involved in this particular story?
Well, as you mentioned, I've covered these conflicts from their inception, so for a couple of decades, but for mostly for National Journal, which is kind of a policy magazine. So my reporting was typically talking to the generals and the senior leadership about, you know, how they thought their strategies were being implemented, et cetera. But I was always struck by the young men and women who served so courageously on the front lines. And I, of course, ran across them many times over my reporting trips and wanted an opportunity to tell their stories because it's their lives that are most directly impacted by these strategic decisions that I'd covered for so long. And I got an opportunity, the Navy Department reached out to me. The most recent Medal of Honor recipient at that time, a couple of years ago, was a Navy SEAL named Britt Slavinsky. And I just, in the interviewing Britt Slavinsky, I was just so, amazed at the story. It was almost Homeric in its kind of dimensions and And there's all these decision points where each time, you know, Slabinski and his whole team, you know, could have done the easy and the safer thing, and they chose to do the hard and dangerous thing because it meant going back up on a mountain and getting a fallen comrade. And I was just so inspired by the drama, and but also from the courage that these men, to a person, showed, that I wanted to tell more stories like this.
Well, I mean, his story is they're all amazing stories. I mean, they just make the hair on the back of your neck stand up every time you read them. And I mean, the interesting thing about Slabinski is that he is, I guess you could say, his friend John Chapman received his Medal of Honor for the same battle, isn't it?
Right, and that's pretty rare. Although there are three battles depicted in the book where there not one but two service members received the Medal of Honor, which is exceedingly rare, looking back in history. And so, yeah, that's very rare. And they were bunkmates in their tent in the Special Forces camp. Used to play chess all the time, you know, to take their minds off the war. And it was heart-rending because they lost John Chapman up on top of that mountain, and thought he was shot and killed. It turns out a drone captures him. He was knocked out, but he was not killed. Woke up and fought bravely for another 20 minutes, and eventually sacrificed his life, left his fighting position to lay down cover for a quick reaction force helicopter that was coming to try to rescue him. So it was, you know, these stories are full of bravery, but also heart-rending tragedy as well. And it's part and parcel of these stories. You can't get away from it.
No, you really can't. I was thinking before we were going on the air, we had a Medal of Honor recipient here in our local area. Charles Kettles was a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, and he had received the number two medal, a service medal.
Service cross, I think, probably.
Right. Finally got it upgraded only less than a year before he passed away. But he was probably, and you mentioned this in the book, and this is kind of a common theme that runs through all of these men that you've talked about here, how humble he was about, you know, the award to begin with, which, you know, everybody looks up to. He can't help but look up to it. And that he always gathered his whole crew around him. Whenever he was talking about what occurred on the day that, you know, he earned the Medal of Honor, is he always talked about his crew and how he could never have done it without them. And this seems to be a running theme throughout all of these, that they could not accomplish their missions without the teamwork that was involved. And when I said at the beginning of the program, you know, that I was part of Army Aviation and we, you know, the motto is above the best, I didn't even really appreciate that myself until I started talking through Veterans Radio, really, to all of the men and women who have been on the ground. Because those, I mean, that is really where everything happens.
Sure. And you mentioned that is a common thread through these stories, is this humility these remarkable individuals show. And, you know, the comment was made more than once to me that, you know, although this is a great honor, it's also a very weighty burden, because it reminds these individuals of the worst day of their lives when they lost friends and comrades and brothers in arms and just saw horrific things and had to do extraordinary things to survive. But they bear that burden because they want to bring attention to their teammates and their colleagues and their brothers in arms. And so there's 25 individual stories here of Medal of Honor recipients, but it's not just stories of them. It's stories of their units and their teams, because without exception, the teams show just extreme, extreme valor. These individuals stood out, but they are, you know, the company of heroes reflected in this book is not just the Medal of Honor recipients, it's many of the service members around them who had their back.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of great side stories that you bring into this. We're talking with James Kitfield. He's the author of In the Company of Heroes. It's the inspiring stories of Medal of Honor recipients from America's longest wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And in fact, I'm going to read, there's a quote on the back cover here. And this is from General David Petraeus, former commander of the surge in Iraq, U.S. Central Command Coalition Forces in Afghanistan, and former director of the CIA. And he says, a tremendous tribute to the bravest of the brave in Iraq and Afghanistan, James Kitfield's In the Company of Heroes is a dramatic and enthralling reminder that even in the toughest of times in the post 9/11 wars, the extraordinary men and women in uniform who fought America's longest wars never backed down from the enemy, never quit on the mission, and most important, always remained true to each other. This important book describes brilliantly why those of us privileged to lead our men and women in combat truly consider them America's new greatest generation. I cannot recommend it too highly. That's from General Petraeus. And I was listening to some of the other interviews that you have given, and this is a kind of a topic that comes up because of the withdrawal from Afghanistan that was so chaotic, that some of these people or some of these men and women are probably suffering from post-traumatic stress just from the idea that we didn't accomplish our mission.
Yeah, to a person, and I've written a lot recently in my journalistic hat about the withdrawal from Afghanistan and how it went so wrong. But it suffice to say, I mean, it is a gut punch to all who served there. I mean, to see that it's bad enough pulling out, but to see the Taliban roll in behind you was just heartbreaking for those who, you know, lost blood, sweat, and tears over there. And there's no doubt that this will cause them to, you know, relive, you know, some of the worst days of their lives. And so, you know, the question was asked of me a number of times, you know, so what we did, what we sacrificed, was it in vain? My answer was always no. I was in Washington, D.C. as a national security correspondent on 9/11 and spent the next, you know, 5 to 10 years engrossed in trying to understand how we got hit like that, who did it, why, and understand everything about Al-Qaeda. And I can tell you personally, for all the many counterterrorism experts I spoke with in and out of government, thought we were going to be hit again with successive 9/11 type terror spectaculars in the years to come. And we weren't hit again like that because we sent our service members over to fight the terrorists where they were home based. And that meant going to Afghanistan, toppling the Taliban, decimating the top leadership of Al-Qaeda, including Osama bin Laden. It meant after the Iraq invasion, fighting Al-Qaeda in Iraq and decimating that organization and killing its leader, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And we also decimated the leadership and decimated the caliphate of the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. So all of those groups want nothing more than to strike a 9/11 type blow against the West. And the reason they weren't able to is because we had pressure on them. They were constantly looking over their shoulders, having to wonder if we were coming to get them. And that's what kept us safe. So that is not in vain. That service kept us safe. The question, you know, the withdrawal from Afghanistan raises, will we be able to continue to keep the country safe now that that region is now pretty fertile ground for them to lay roots again? And we will find out about that.
Yeah, that's always the issue. And, you know, when we leave these places is what happens to the people that are left behind. And, you know, we can see some of the results from what news is coming out of Afghanistan. And you know, I keep flashing back, of course, to Vietnam when we were out of there in 75 and, you know, who we had left behind with that. But that's getting way off topic. And I apologize for that, James. Let's go back to the Medal of Honor. Let's talk a little bit about the history of the Medal of Honor. How did this award come about?
It was started by President Lincoln during the Civil War, wanting to honor. Originally, it was just for NCOs and enlisted personnel, but it was expanded in '83 to include officers as well, just in time for Chamberlain, who led the bayonet charge down Little Round Top to save the flank of the Union line during the Battle of Gettysburg, to receive the Medal of Honor. And from then on, in every war we've had, there have been Medal of Honor recipients showing, you know, just extraordinary valor, and that, you know, right up through World War One and World War Two, Korea, Vietnam, and now the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's just that when you have face to face combat, some people will distinguish themselves in those situations, and we, you know, the services want to draw attention to that because those people are exemplary, and they want to show the bravest of the brave, as General Petraeus said.
Right. And it's not the easiest award to be given because of there are, I guess, the rules and regulations that go behind it, because there's supposed to be witnesses and, you know, written statements and so on and so forth, aren't there?
Right. So it's a very involved process, which is why in many cases there's years passed between the action itself and the receiving of the award. And so your chain of command has to recommend a service member for the Medal of Honor. It has to go up through the chain of command, if they think it indeed is worthy, they'll launch an investigation that talks to witnesses, interviews witnesses, looks at all the data from the battle. In these wars, there's obviously a lot more data because we have full video in some cases of these wars, because there's surveillance drones circling overhead. But it goes up to this investigation, then finally the Secretary of Defense has to sign off on it, and the final decision is the President of the United States makes the decision, and the awards are given at the White House. So it's a quite involved process. It's not something that's done lightly.
No, not at all. And in your book, you mentioned that you had the privilege, I guess you could say, of going to a Medal of Honor reunion where there aren't that many left.
No, they have each year, the Medal of Honor Society holds this annual meeting. The one you're referring to was held at the Naval Academy a couple of years ago, but I went to the one just before COVID, which was in Tampa. And it's a chance to honor all of these individuals, and they go out and speak to local schools. And, you know, it's just, you know, it is the most exclusive fraternity in the world. And so people are just flocked to be able to meet these people. And for good reason. They're just extraordinary individuals. Like you said, for all of their accomplishments and achievements, they remain a very humble crowd. I should also say that a lot of them have been very public about their own struggles with post-traumatic stress mental issues. And, you know, they're the bravest of the brave, but they talk about this because they want, you know, veterans and other combat veterans and service members to seek out help when they are trying to cope with their own post-traumatic stress. And that would be a good time, if you don't mind, I can give the number out for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. Which is 800.
I have it sitting here in front of me too.
Yeah, that's 800-273-8255. That's the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. So these individuals, almost to a person, have suffered post-traumatic stress. I mean, if you read these stories, you understand why, what they've been through, what they've seen, what they've lost. And they are very open about those struggles because, in one example, was an attempted suicide himself, one of these Medal of Honor recipients, Dakota Meyer. They want those stories out too, because they think they want to get rid of the stigma about seeking help for post-traumatic stress, because they've all been through it.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing probably is they don't want people thinking of them as, you know, Superman, and, you know, that they're above the fray, but they're not. They're just, you know, as we always say, you know, they're just ordinary people who did extraordinary things in the service of their country. And I just can't remember the particular story where the Medal of Honor recipient, another one of his team members, after the battle and everything, everybody came home, that did eventually, unfortunately, did commit suicide. And, you know, for our audience out there that's listening right now, we're all very familiar with the number 22 a day. And even though that has dropped minusculely, if that's a word, there's still over 20 veterans a day that are committing suicide. And so we have to make sure that they're aware that help is out there, and that it is not wrong to seek out that help. And every one of these stories that I've read in this book talk about the survivors that are talking about, yes, seek help. We can't fight these battles by ourselves.
That's exactly right. I mean, and these individuals are very outspoken about, again, what they've been through, because they want other combat veterans to know that there's help out there. And there's, you know, the bravest of the brave need help too. And they want to make sure that if people need that kind of help, they seek it out. Cause, you're right. You can't fight those battles alone.
No, not at all. I want to read another quote here. It's this is from Stanley McChrystal, General Stanley McChrystal. And he says, every generation must do its part. And fortunately, heroes emerge. In his fascinating account, James Kitfield shares stories that will inspire Americans of this and future times. And I think we'd better get into this, some of these stories. And I know I asked you earlier if you had any that you would prefer to talk about or that you want to talk about.
Well, you know, it's like choosing between your children, right? There's 25 just unbelievable stories in this book. Each one is individual, is extraordinary in their own right and did extraordinary things. I'll talk a little bit about Bruce Levinsky since he started, that interview started me on this journey, if you will. So he was in Afghanistan as a young SEAL team leader, in 2002. So very early in the post 9/11 wars. And they had, if you'll remember, an initial battle in Tora Bora, Al-Qaeda had been allowed to, Osama bin Laden and his lieutenants had been allowed to basically get away into Pakistan because we had trusted some local warlords to close the noose around it. So this battle was had singled out a group of Al-Qaedas that were in the mountains, and they were trying to close the net on them. He was in charge of an overwatch team, and they were inserted at night on top of this mountain. Snow in the middle, this is in February, snow drifts up there, freezing cold. They, because of a screw up in timing, they can't disembark, you know, and sneak into their overwatch position. They have to, the helicopter has to drop them off right at top of the mountain. Helicopter's ambushed. And in the ambush, trying to get out of it, and you as a helicopter pilot would understand this, it's miraculous. They took RPG hits. They did get out of it and crash landed a few miles away, but in the confusion, one of the SEALs falls out of the back of the helicopter. So they've crashed, you know, before even sunrise, they crash landed in a helicopter, got taken back to, they've been ambushed, they've lost a man, and they got to go back to base. And Brick Slavinsky, you know, this is one of those decision points, has to decide, you know, do I risk my whole team in what is certainly going to be a suicide mission to go rescue the Navy SEAL Roberts, Neil Roberts, or do I just say do I save my team? Because it was clearly going to be something like a suicide mission. The Al-Qaeda group on top of the mountain was bigger than they were, dug in, and they would be fighting uphill and through snow drifts. And yet they decided to go back, and he announced that decision to his team and to a person, including John Chapman and all five of them, you know, shook their head and said, let's go get them. And knowing what their odds were, and they weren't good. And indeed, when they went back up, helicopter again is ambushed. They get out this time. They fight really fiercely. But John Chapman is hit and presumed dead. Another Navy SEAL shot through the leg, would lose that leg. So he's a major casualty. They have to retreat off that mountain, or at least down the mountain. But as I said before, the drone catches the firing position where John Chapman was laying unconscious for 12 minutes. He starts moving around and then starts fighting fiercely. And in a couple of cases, hand-to-hand combat as he held off this Al-Qaeda group, almost out of ammunition when the quick reaction force helicopter appears to try to rescue him, and he exposes himself to what he knew was mortal danger to try to lay down fire for that helicopter, and he's killed. So just a heart-rending, tragic story, but full of inspiring, men who live by the creed, we leave none of our own behind. And there's inspiration in that I wanted to share with readers. And there's 25 stories like that.
Exactly, and that's something that is instilled in you from their first day of basic training, I think, is that you never leave anyone back out on the field. I can think of so many missions where we would go back to try and find people, and you know the helicopter pilots that received the Medal of Honors in from Vietnam were all going back to pick up people that were still on the ground. And you can't leave them. That's just the way it is. And these mountains that you were talking about in Afghanistan are not, these are 15,000-16,000 foot up.
The Hindu Kush is, you know, if it wasn't for this conflict, it'd be, I've heard this comment by many people who served there, just some of the most beautiful mountains in the world, but they are, they have some of the most remote valleys, you know, valleys where the inhabitants have never even seen the people in the next valley, much less American troops. So we spent, you know, probably five or six of these stories are from units that we put up deep in these mountains to try to sort of plug the infiltration routes that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were using to come from the Pakistan sanctuaries into Afghanistan. And those stories are harrowing because they are typically outnumbered, surrounded by these wily mountain fighters who grew up in those mountains. And they are very hard to be reinforced and very hard to get air cover because they're so remote. And there are just a number of really, really dramatic battles in those in the Hindu Kush. Just really heart-rending stuff because it was probably the toughest terrain on earth to try to fight in.
I know, and they were out there in such small fire support bases, or, you know, their bases were not very big at all.
No, and if you'll remember, this was largely when you know, the Iraq war was not going well. So we had to siphon off the majority. The Iraq war was the major effort, and Afghanistan was like a holding mission.
Right.
And because of that, they didn't have anything like the heavy lift helicopters, the ISR in terms of surveillance drones. They were shorthanded and they were short equipped. And in these terribly remote places, and often outnumbered, because the Taliban can choose when to mass its forces on one of these remote bases. So that was a tactically really, really difficult duty in those mountains. And eventually, after the last one, Kop Keating, which is another one of these famous conflicts, battles where there were two Elevana recipients from that same battle. They were very nearly overrun. There was inside the enemy got inside the wire, killed a lot of Americans, and they were just able to fight them off. But after that, the U.S. military put all of our forces out of those mountains and bombed them to not let the equipment fall into the hands of the enemy. But they realized they were just putting these units in really indefensible positions.
Yeah, and some of them, their positions were outrageous. I mean, I think it's that story you were talking about where the base was between the mountains. It was in the valley. Everything was above you.
Right. That was Kop Keating. Yeah, but they called it the fishbowl because everyone. One of the Medal of Honor recipients looked up and said, "You know what? I'm gonna have a very sore neck after this year deployment because I'm constantly looking up this whole time." And they were, you know, shot at by snipers so regularly that they were afraid to in daylight to even go to the latrine. They had to wait till night to crawl to the latrine because there were so many snipers and hiding in the rocks on the mountainside. So, gives you an idea of how what kind of duty that was.
We're talking right now with James Kitfield. He's the author of In the Company of Heroes, the Inspiring Stories of Medal of Honor Recipients from the Iraq and Afghanistan Wars. We have to take a quick break. So, James, if you'll stick around. Actually, this is where we pay a little respect to one of the Medal of Honor recipients that is in your book, and that is going to be Paul Smith. So you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we'll be right back after this short break.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position. But then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50-caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Military veterans touch everyone's life. I'm guessing right now you're thinking of a veteran, a close friend, relative. Maybe it's you. Even the toughest of us sometimes need help, but don't know where to turn for support. You don't need special training to help a veteran in your life. We can all help someone going through a difficult time. Learn how you can be there for veterans. Visit VeteransCrisisLine.net. VeteransCrisisLine.net. A message from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs.
We're back here on Veterans Radio, and we are talking with James Kitfield, and the author of In the Company of Heroes, the Medal of Honor recipients from Iraq and Afghanistan. And that Medal of Honor that just played was about Paul Smith. And I just wanted to read a paragraph from the end of the chapter on Paul Smith in here called The Gates of Baghdad. And it's evidently when Paul Smith's belongings were sent home, his parents found a letter that he had written from Iraq but had never mailed it. And in it, he told his parents how proud he was of the privilege to be given 25 of the finest Americans we call soldiers to lead into war. And then Paul Ray Smith made a pledge to put their welfare first, which he would honor with his life. He was prepared, Smith wrote, to give all that I am to ensure all of my boys make it home. And this is like a common story for all of these Medal of Honor recipients, James.
Yes, that's exactly right. And the thread that runs through all these stories is people who are selfless, and when they had a brush with eternity, instead of doing the safe thing, they put their lives on the line in order to save their buddies. There were seven, I believe, that were actually threw themselves on a grenade or tackled a suicide bomber to absorb the blast and protect their brothers in arms, knowing that they were about to die. And but they went ahead and did it. And you know, certainly Paul Smith, I was actually embedded with the small headquarters element, tactical headquarters element, right behind his unit. And so that was in the original invasion of Iraq. And I mean that his engineering battalion just did amazing things. They captured a contested bridge and waded into the water and were cutting the wires of the demolition that the Iraqi Republican Guard types had put on the bridge to blow it up. So they were quite a unit. And at that Air Force battle, the Baghdad airport was from the very beginning the place where we were going to try to capture and then launch the battle for Baghdad, if you will, from the airport complex. And that little courtyard that he set up and was going to be for prisoners, that turned out to be the flank of the unit that was fighting to capture the airport. So if he had allowed the Iraqi Republican Guards to sweep through them, he would have jeopardized the flank of the whole effort to capture the Air Force. So the airport, I should say. So he was an amazing guy, and he was determined that they would go no further than him and his 50-caliber machine gun on top of a armored personnel carrier that was disabled. So he couldn't even pull that out of the field of fire if he had wanted to. And he never left. He just said, keep feeding me bullets and I'll keep firing. So he was an extremely heroic sergeant.
It was, and you were talking about the couple of people who jumped on brigade or on grenades, and I'm, you know, we have another one of our Medal of Honor segments where we talk about Ross McGinnis. Can you talk about what he did?
Ross McGinnis. Well, I'm trying to remember right off the top of my head. Oh, so he was. He was in Iraq, fighting in a, what they call sort of the really, really rough part of Baghdad that I've actually been through myself, wouldn't want to go back again. And they were in a convoy. He manned the machine gun on top of a Humvee. And so he's the gunner, and they turn a corner, down a dusty street, and someone dropped a grenade through his turnstile, if you will. And at that point, he was the only one in this armored Humvee who could get out. He could have just hopped out the top because he was standing up, you know, behind his machine gun. Instead of that, he drops down into the Humvee and basically captures the grenade against the bulwark with his his body armor, knowing that that was going to be the last thing he ever did. But he saved everyone else in that Humvee by that heroic sacrifice of his own life.
I just can't believe what these people did. We talked with Flo Groberg on Veterans Radio back in December of 2017, and his Medal of Honor was received for basically tackling a suicide bomber who was trying to get to a general or some brigade commander or something along those lines, and pushed him aside, and the vest went off.
Yeah, and you know, Flo's a great guy, and he not only tackled the suicide bomber, but he went through just incredibly difficult rehabilitation. He lost most of one of his legs. You know, he had been a standout track star in college. He's an immigrant, his story was just amazing. How he found his inner warrior again. That allowed him to press through really excruciating rehabilitation and become this really, interesting entrepreneurial guy who has a great life. But it was the story of how he struggled. I mean, the survivor's guilt that he suffered almost drove him crazy. And he admits this in his book, and at his lowest point, another one of the soldiers at Walter Reed who had lost, I believe, both arms and both legs came to him and said, look, I know you're having a bad time. There's people in this hospital who have it even worse than you, and you need to rediscover your warrior. And Froberg said that person saved his life. So that's another one of the stories in there. That just shows you how these people all have each other's back, and really showed amazing courage in coming to each other's aid when it mattered most.
I think it's really interesting and just, I don't know, awe-inspiring when you think about, especially some of the ones that did survive. You talked about in the book. You're talking about Corporal Kyle Carpenter, and we had the privilege of talking with him back in December of 2019, but he was literally blown apart and survived.
Absolutely. He's an amazing person. Another case, a young Marine in Afghanistan, in the Kandahar, sort of the birthplace of the Taliban, and they're manning an overwatch position on top of a roof on their little makeshift base, and a grenade gets thrown on top of the rooftop. He jumps on top of it to try to save his friend. And, he was hurt so badly that I don't think many people thought he would survive. But it was miraculous that he survived. But he had to go through more than 40 operations to put himself back together. And it really excruciating pain. You know, you're doped up on a lot of pain medication. You're having hallucinations. He hallucinated that he saw his own burial, and none of his Marine friends came to see him because they were mad at him for leaving them in Afghanistan, if you can imagine that. But this young man, who could have been totally embittered by this experience, really found his meaning in life and has become a motivational speaker. You've talked to him. He's just a really inspiring person, and has a Twitter handle, Chicks Dig Scars, has a sense of humor, but he's almost like a warrior philosopher. So he took the worst day of his life, and he made it life changing. And, just an amazing, amazing young man.
I to our audience out there, as I mentioned, we're talking with James Kitfield. The book is In the Company of Heroes. I can't recommend highly enough that you go out and read these stories. And I know that sooner or later there's going to be a woman that's going to receive the Medal of Honor. And it's going to be the same thing. They just go above and beyond whatever it is. And they never, ever give up.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm looking at the names on the list here, you know, I can't even, you know, I don't even know where I want to go first because they're all such just fantastic stories. I'm going to ask you while I'm going to go on here for a minute about Kyle White and in a second. But there are 25 stories in the book about Medal of Honor recipients. And, you know, luckily it seems like most of them survived. Some of them did not. But I wanted to ask you about Kyle White.
So Kyle White was with a unit in, again, one of these units I talked about in the Hindu Kush. They go into a village late at night and camp out, and they're supposed to meet with the elders the next morning to do outreach, like, which is what their mission really was try to sort of gain the trust of these mountain villages, so they would be told when the Taliban was lurking around. And something didn't feel right. They were the meeting kept getting pushed back, and when it finally happened, almost every man of fighting age showed up, and they started hearing strange commands on the radio in a language that even their interpreters didn't understand. So something didn't feel right. So they exited this village and were walking back a single file through on this goat trail trying to get home. And they go to a park named Ambush Alley because it's famous for the Taliban liking to ambush people there. And indeed, they do get ambushed. He gets knocked out by an RPG. And when he awakens, almost his whole unit has disappeared. He doesn't know what happened to them. But he and a couple of Afghans and a couple of wounded Americans are the only people left on this ridgeline. And he helps save one person. He treats his wounds. He's fighting off the enemy. And if it wasn't for him, you know, everyone who was left on that mountain would have died. He's calling in airstrikes, et cetera, and quite famously, almost every commander in Afghanistan was on the radio and that listened to this young trooper who I think was, you know, early 20s at the time, was just managing this fight all on his own. And he was the last person to, he made sure that they evacuated everyone else besides himself. And finally, he was the last man off that mountain and saved a lot of lives in the process.
It's awesome. I know that's not the right word, but it's just, you know, what these people can do. Your last story in the book is about Army Sergeant First Class Thomas Paine, and you call that chapter Last Man Out. Why is that?
So Sergeant Paine was a member of the Ranger Regiment who famously fought in so many battles in these wars, especially in both Iraq and Afghanistan. But he's involved in the fight against the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. So he's the most recent and the last, chronologically the last Medal of Honor recipient when I wrote this book, which is I finished end of last year. So they get word that ISIS is going to execute these hostages, more than 80 hostages, Kurdish, most of them Kurdish military types and Kurdish civilians. And they're digging, they're digging the graves outside the prison where they're going to shoot them and execute them, which is their sort of brand, if you will. And they launch a very dangerous hostage rescue mission. And during that mission, they lose, Thomas Paine lost one of his colleagues. But the prison is burning. It gets lit on fire during this firefight trying to rescue the hostages. And he has the bolt cutter. So he runs into, under machine gun fire, ISIS is firing from within the prison. He goes under machine gun fire three times into a burning building where the smoke is so deep, that it's so dense, it's about knee high that you could get a breath. And three times he goes back in there to try to get open this door under fire. And eventually actually does do that and is able to then usher out. Many of the hostages were so scared because there was still an ongoing firefight inside the building and it's burning. And he had to basically, you know, bodily sort of get them out of there. And they rescued all 80 hostages. And it was just an amazing thing to hear how this unassuming, not very big guy, these guys, you think big hulking guys, and they're not. They're wiry types frequently. But he just, you know, was telling me this story, and I couldn't imagine what it would be like to be him and to decide not once, not twice, but three times to run down a hall while you're getting machine gun shot at you and into a burning building, you know, it's about to collapse at any moment. And to save strangers. And that's what he did. And it's an inspiring story, but it was harrowing as well.
Every one of these, as I mentioned earlier on, got the hair on my neck standing straight up going, why? You know, it's like watching a movie. Don't go in there.
Right.
Because it's not going to be good for you. What would you say would be one common trait that all of these men had? In fact, most of them, as you mentioned, were fairly young.
Right. So there is a selflessness in all of these stories that when it came right down to it, they were willing to sacrifice their lives to save the lives of their fellow service members and brothers in arms. And that comes through in literally, I think, every one of these stories. They could have taken the easy way out and no one would have thought less of them. Some of these things were, you know, like I said, as stark as jumping on a grave knowing you're going to die. Or going back up in a mountain when you know it's a suicide mission. But they did it, and they did it because they valued the lives of their colleagues and the creed that you leave no man behind more than their own lives. And that's a common thread that comes through all these stories. And it's, you know, that's the inspiring part, I think, that, we have such a, you know, this force of volunteers that we sent to fight these wars. Are as good as any force we've ever fielded in our country's history. And each one of them volunteered for duty. They weren't drafted. They didn't have to do it, but they volunteered to do it.
No, and so many of them were on their fifth, sixth, seventh, ninth tours. Granted, they're not a year long, but they're, you know, still just the psychological buildup to going back into combat is so foreign to my thinking. I mean, there wasn't any way you were going to get me to go back to Vietnam. And they keep going back.
That was one of the military would never go back on the all volunteer force. But one of the repercussions of having a fairly small volunteer force that fought our longest wars was they did have to go back and back and back and back. And each time, you know, with studies have shown your likelihood of having post-traumatic stress issues goes up. And it's also very tough on families to go through that again and again and again. So that was one of the detriments of having an all-volunteer force that was relatively small that we never reinforced with an all-around draft. Now, the military would tell you that the fact that they're volunteers is why they're so good. You know, it's a professional force. But it did have some drawbacks in the sense that we had to send it back to so many times, and that you know, they suffered for that.
I can't imagine. I mean, I know the draft supposedly, you know, went after everybody, and we know that didn't necessarily work out quite evenly. But you know, they weren't professional. They just, you know, okay, I'm going to be out in 2 years, or I'm going to be out in, you know, 60 days, or whatever it might be. You know, the politicians couldn't stand up under the pressure of the people at home saying, no, 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 not my son. And, you know, right now you're talking about an elite fighting force that's from all over the country. And that's a great thing I liked about the military is you got to meet people from everywhere. And, you know, you'd never would have, you know, I'm from New Jersey originally, and I never would have hung out with people from Mississippi or Texas or Kansas or California. If I hadn't gone into the service, I would have known nothing about that part of the world.
That's right. And that's one of the beauties of military service is that you are thrown together, you know, with people who you would never normally associate with or even have a chance to meet. And I found that to be one of the most ennobling things about military service. And I think, you know, we lose something when we don't have that. But, yeah, like I said, the military, the politicians were not anxious to make a tough decision on reinstating the draft, and the military didn't want it because they had these really good volunteers who are professionals who stay around a lot longer. And for a high-tech military, that's preferable than having draftees who don't really want to be there. Can I read you a quote from David Bolavia, who's one of the Medal of Honor recipients in here?
Sure, absolutely.
So this stuck out to me because it gets to this partisanship that we're experiencing in this country now, and how these stories, none of that comes through. And he said, there's a million plus reasons why Americans are divided right now. And throughout our history, we've always disagreed and dissented, but we always found a way to put our differences aside and focus on what's best for the nation when it counted most. And he's talking about the Army here. We don't care if your dad died and left you millions of dollars or not. I personally never cared what God a soldier worshiped, what color they were, or who they love. If someone is willing to get shot at for me and my buddy, I will lead or follow you anywhere. And I think that's pretty reflective of the values these guys put on the teamwork and the bonds of friendship and brothers in arms that form. And no one's asking what party you're from. They're a team, and they'll literally die for each other. And that's something you don't see very often in American society anymore.
No, you don't. And unfortunately, we are coming up against the clock, so I want to make sure I get this out one more time. James Kitfield, the book is In the Company of Heroes, the inspiring stories of Medal of Honor recipients from America's longest wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. James, I want to thank you very much for your time today. I encourage people to go out and buy this book. I think you're going to be really impressed with the kind of men and women that we've got in today's military.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed today's program, In the Company of Heroes, the book by James Kitfield. Wow. You know, these men that have been awarded the Medal of Honor are just so special, and they are all so humble. You know, I've had the privilege here on Veterans Radio of talking to about 30 living Medal of Honor recipients, and it's been such an honor to talk to these men. But that common thread that runs through all of them is how humble that they are, how it's never them, it's always, you know, the other troops that deserve the award, and just great men. So anyway, I hope you enjoyed the program. It was very meaningful to me to play this today. Somebody was asking me, Dale, why are you playing God Bless America and America the Beautiful at the end of the programs these days? And I said, well, mainly is to remind everybody of what an incredible, wonderful country that we live in. It's not perfect. We know that. But we are a work in progress, and we are still continuing to try and try and try. And I just feel that I am so fortunate and lucky to have been born in the United States of America. I just want to share that enthusiasm with you every week. So we're going to go out today on a version of God Bless America and America the Beautiful done by the Brothers of the Heart. This is one of my favorite versions. So until next week, this is Dale Thronberry. For all of us here at Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night with the light from above. From the mountain to the prairie to the ocean white with foam, God bless America, my home sweet home. God bless America, my home sweet home. Oh,
God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining. The prairies to the oceans, white with